broadcasting from the spooky South Coast and around the world on Midnight.fm. This is Midnight Society. I am your host, Tim Weisberg. Whether it is the brightest of day or the darkest of night, wherever you may be, it's time to hunker down for the next 3 hours as we enter into a world of wonder and weird you won't hear anywhere else. And tonight we're going to be talking about one of the most strange and interesting cases you may have ever heard about, or maybe you've never heard about. We're going to get all the details, all the information about the Dyatlov Pass incident. And if you have never heard this story before, it is a rabbit hole of potential weird. It is something that is one of those mysteries where once you start, I don't know if you can stop. And that's what's happened with our guest tonight. We'll be talking with Teodora Hajiska. We're going to be talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident for the entire program. We're going to be finding out all the details, all the inside information, all the research that she has done over the past few years of putting all this together on her fantastic website, by the way. If you are listening along and in front of your computer, then I would actually recommend, you know, normally we say, you know, during the program, go to midnight.fm and you can find all the information about the guest there. And you can. If you go there, you will find the link to her website. But if you just go to dyatlovpass.com, that's dyatlovpass.com, have that open during the discussion tonight, because everything that you could possibly need to follow along is right there. Photographs, journal entries, maps, information, all of that is right there as we talk about the Dyatlov Pass incident, which happened in February of 1959 when a group of 9 hikers were killed in the Russian wilderness under very bizarre circumstances. So now, 61 years later, we still don't know what happened. The mystery surrounding their deaths have never been solved. So tonight we'll find out all of the details that we could possibly know about that case. And I always say it, I say it each and every Friday, that on Friday nights here on Midnight Society, we send you into the weekend with something that will leave you thinking. Something that will keep your mind working all weekend long. And I think we definitely have one of those shows on the table for you tonight. So let's get right into it. Let's not waste any time. Our guest tonight, Teodora Hajiska, was born in Bulgaria and grew up in Cuba. She has a master's degree in architecture and civil engineering and ran a web design business during the dot-com bubble. Teddy currently lives in Austria with her husband, and they spend most of their time as travelers discovering the world. And we nailed her down for a few hours here. We kept her in one place long enough to join us tonight. Good evening, Teddy. How are you?
Good evening, Tim.
Well, I say good evening to you, but it's very early morning where you are.
Yes, it's 4 a.m. in Vienna.
And we appreciate you, you know, getting up earlier, staying up late, however you did it. But we appreciate you, you know, joining us in these odd hours.
Well, good evening to all the fellow mystery buffs as well who are joining us tonight.
And, you know, we like to say here on Midnight Society that, you know, we go deeper. We like to do deep dives into a lot of these topics. And that's something that has happened with you and the Dyatlov Pass incident. I think I have never seen a single case with a website as detailed with a collection of information that you have there. How long have you been researching this incident?
Since 2012, which makes it 8 years.
And I've heard go ahead.
I didn't plan to start the site or even to get involved. I'll tell you more about how I started doing the site and being sucked into the whole of the Dyatlov Pass.
Sure, yeah. It seems like I've heard little bits and pieces of the story, but it seems like, you know, it was a very interesting circumstance that brought you to the case.
Right. Well, you mentioned that I was into the web design business when it was big. I was living in LA and I was doing all the movie sites, and I was working with Sony Classics and by the time was Paramount Pictures, and I was happy with my life. And then I went on a travel and I met somebody that had abandoned going 9 to 5 into an office and having a job, and he was a full-time traveler. So I said, why can't I do the same? This is how I joined my husband, Yuri Varushanov, and we started going places, mountains, and we developed this taste for volcanoes. So in one of our trips, we had this accident. Well, it's statistics. If you do a lot of risky things, you might actually be faced with the risk something to happen to you. So we had a nearly fatal car accident, which left me almost dying in Indonesia when we were going down from an active volcano, Karangetan. And I was with a flail chest, broken scapula, with hemorrhaging, with the subdural hematoma in my brain, and I almost died, and I had to undergo several operations, surgeries, which started in Malaysia and then continued in Vienna. And during that time, when I was recovering, I saw a movie, and I almost forgot about it the moment it ended. But then Yuri said, you know, there is a real event behind this movie, and it wasn't even called Dyatlov Pass, it was called the Devil's Pass. Mm-hmm. And I just read about Dyatlov Pass incident, and this is how it started. I was thrown into this information. It was so scattered. It's a Russian domain. I mean, the Russians know about this case. It's we have to peel it, slowly dig into the geological layers of information, because they have discussed this for many, many decades. And since I had the business and the server, I started for my own sake structuring the information about the Dyatlov Pass. This is how I started. It's a lot of names. On my site, you will see who is table, because once you encounter a name, you have to keep track of who was he and when was he mentioned. This is very important. Okay, but I'm going far ahead of myself. So I started putting the information on this website, and I saw that it's not so easy and simple to actually adopt a theory, to like a theory. And nothing made sense. I started continuing finding information and research, so hoping that it will clear out for myself what happened, and I would finally find peace and continue traveling. Actually, I did go for 6 months to South America, and then my site got a lot of traffic and comments, and I saw that I have to extend to a forum. So I started the first forum in English. The link to it could be seen at your site at the Midnight FM. And people from all over the world started asking for more information. But Google doesn't translate well Russian. And I'm in this unique position that I know Russian since I have been born in Bulgaria, and we're a socialist country. We were the little brother of the Soviet Union, so we learned Russian in school. My middle name is Anatolieva, so I know Russian and I know English since I have lived in the United States for 10 years and still having business there. And I was in this position that I was a mountaineer. And on top of everything, I suffered an accident which left me with exactly the traumas and the injuries of most of the worst cases in this case. I mean, there are two people in this case that died from a high velocity trauma, something that the pathologist at the time said that could be caused only from something like a fast moving vehicle, or if you fall from very high, like the sixth floor of a building, but there is nothing like that at the place where they were found. So let's start from the beginning. How were they found, and where the mystery begins, actually? Yeah. Should I go? In the timeline.
But just real quick before we jump into the actual events of it, you know, you mentioned that, you know, these things seem like they were building toward you having to be the person that puts all this together. So before we even launch into all the details, do you feel like it was kind of the universe putting you on this path?
Tim, it is. I have never had a physical response to any information like this one. I have flail chest with 6 broken ribs, and literally my bones hurt when I'm closer to the truth. So I know that it was meant to happen because everything it's coming to me very easily. I mean, it's not that I don't do the work and I'm not putting a lot of time into this because I'm translating and publishing everything so everybody can have a try to crack the case. But it's I'm named an expert, but I became an expert because the Russians came to me with information. They said that I have made the first site that has all the information together, structured well with all the information, because they're usually discussing this in forums and it's very hard to read so many postings. So they came to me and we became friends. So the Russians are helping me a lot with their research and I'm jumping ahead. So they're helping me. I'm translating and making it available on my site. It's not a one person endeavor. I'm not alone in this. And I am so far ahead with the information and knowledge about the case because of the Russians. I mean, I really own them a lot of the site. And also, I went to the past last year. I want to mention that. And I want to extend my deep gratitude to Discovery Channel. They chose me, invited me as an expert. So I had a breakthrough on the location because we went there in February when exactly at the 60th anniversary of the incident, we were there. And I understood so much about the case. And actually, I had a revelation right there. I'm not talking about the case the same way as I was portraying it and before I went to the past. And also, the Russians came to me with a lot of documents that are not available in English. And I'm putting everything there. So it's on the past when Josh Gates, the host of the Expedition Unknown, when he was asking me questions, I said, you know, I know that because the Russian friends and sources gave it to me. And he said that I'm the conduit. So this is what I call myself. I'm the conduit between the Russians and the English speaking world. But I'm amounting myself some knowledge, and I think that the Hegel's law about quantity becoming a quality finally kicks in, because I have a better understanding of the case since last year.
Right. And I've had that happen before where, you know, I've looked into things that I have an interest in, and then you get the chance to go there and it changes everything. And you say, oh, I understand this so much better. And also you have a little bit of a sense of, you know, I feel like I've been here before kind of undercurrent to it as well.
I felt like I was at the edge of the world. Like, nothing matters. It doesn't matter if we ever prove anything, but I felt like they did because I was under the same sky. I was blown by the same wind, and I understood what they felt, and I knew that some of the speculations that we have about the terrain, about their behavior, about a lot of things, the decisions, the decision they made at that night, because they were, I mean, this was what sealed their fate, were true or not true. Because I'm a mountaineer, I can read the terrain, and I know where I would pitch a tent and which way I would go if I'm facing a disaster or an incident. It's a lot of eye-opening when you actually go there on the terrain. And so it's a very strange story, and it's just snowballing right now as we speak. A new investigation had opened secretly in 2018. First, they said we're not going to investigate anymore. I'm talking about the official prosecutor's office of the Russian Federation. And then they had the official statement in 2018. And then a month later, They said on the annual conference in Ekaterinburg that they have started reading into the case files a month later after they said that they're not going to reopen a new investigation. Now, I want to underline this is not reopening the case because everybody says reopening the case. No, this is a preliminary investigation. They have to find a cause to reopen the case. It has to be foul play or something like that. And the interesting thing is that after we went to the pass, exactly a month after us, the prosecutor's office made their own expedition with Russian Channel 1 and Komsomolskaya Pravda. Komsomolskaya Pravda is a periodical, a very huge publication house in Russia that is very invested in the case. They have their own journalists that have been reporting the case for decades. So these three parties made an expedition in March, exactly a month after us. But the prosecutor's office said that they're going to investigate only natural causes, which is avalanche, snow slab, or a hurricane, which I know hurricane is called something that happens around the water, so we should call it a snowstorm with the force of a hurricane. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe them because they say one thing and then when they find something, they just announce it. And they haven't said anything since then. So it has been more than a year and they haven't said anything since they went to the pass.
Yeah, that you would think that they would have something to at least some sort of comment on it by now.
No, they haven't have any official statement after that. So we're waiting. That's what I'm saying. If you inform yourself and all the listeners know more about the incident, you will see headlines by the end of 2020. You will see headlines about Dyatlov Pass. But you really have to know more to be interested because the details are very bizarre. I mean, no scenario had attempted even to cover all of the facts, explain everything that happens. And the prosecutors are investigating 75 theories. They said they're going to look for natural causes on the past, but there are more than 100 theories until now.
Wow. Well, we'll get into as many of them as we can tonight. I don't know if we'll get into all of those, but we'll get into the big ones for sure. So why don't we get into some of the details of what actually happened during those early days of February of 1959. Tell us first of all, why it's even called the Dyatlov Pass incident.
There is no such a geographical name until now. We put it on the map as a Dyatlov Pass. If you look at the books with the passes in the Northern Urals, there is no such pass, but we call it Dyatlov Pass because there is a monument there. It's actually the easiest, more efficient way to cross from one valley, from Ospia River to Lozva River. And it's just between two, they call them altitudes. They don't even have names to two peaks, which are not very high. Let's say it's go a little bit back. It's Northern Ural where the incident happened. And Ural, I don't know if you imagine on the map, but this is the common boundary. It's considered between Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. So it's a very long vertical mountain ridge, which is 2,500 kilometers, which I believe it's something like 1,800 miles long. And it's divided in five parts. So we have south, middle, north, where the incident happened. And then we have subpolar and polar Urals. And so this happened into the Northern Urals, which the whole Urals doesn't go above 2,000 meters altitude. So we're not talking about very high mountain ridges, but the weather, it's really, really bad. And they went in February, which is considered a winter trek. They're called ski hikers which is cross-country skiing, but not as a sports, but means of transportation. Mm-hmm. They were carrying all of the gear, everything that they will need for their two-week hike, tent and food and stove. They have a very strange stove, which was only for heating, and it was designed by the leader. So we're getting to the name of the pass. The leader was Igor Dyatlov, and this is why they named the pass, or presumably where they actually, we don't know if they went through the pass. This is another strange fact that we don't know which way they went. I'm going to cover that. We don't know at the night when they died, when it happened, which way they took to the place where their final place where the tent was found. But we call the pass where they should be crossing over the ridge, Dyatlov Pass. But maybe they didn't even go there that night. Anyway, so they had to carry everything. And their skis at that time were nothing like what you're using today for cross-country skiing. They were very white, and they were heavy, and they were everything was sticking. The snow was sticking to the skis. It was very difficult to walk, I mean, to traverse and to ski. They were using the frozen surface of the rivers in winter, but still it was sticking to, and they constantly wrote in their diaries that they advanced very slowly because they have to stop and clean the snow that was on the bottom of the skis. And they had to carry everything. So they were very heavy backpacks. They started 10 people. Two of them were women, girls. I mean, they're between 20 and 24 of age, with one exception. I want to pay a special attention to the exception, which I'm going to talk about later on, because he's considered a very mysterious later addition to that group. He's much older. He's 38. So, it's considered a category 3 difficulty trek because it's very resourceful and difficult to go in this wilderness without even decent maps. At the time, it was still the Cold War period, although it was the time of de-Stalinization, Nikita Khrushchev, but still there were no maps. And even the sports club where all these students, the hike was organized by the sports club. Even the sports club didn't give them too detailed of a maps. So they had to improvise at the villages where they were going through. They were talking to the forestry managers, to people there. They were copying, tracing maps of the local businesses that were having maps of the area. And even we know of the name Rempel, which was written at the back page of one of the diaries. And there is a speculation, oh, who is this guy? Maybe he killed them. Well, he was just a forestry director who helped them with the map and told them where the boundaries of the forest end. It was very important for them where the forest ends, because they needed wood to warm themselves and to cook. And their tent, oh, the tent was so painful to imagine how heavy it was. To accommodate 10 people,
oh, yeah,
they stitched together two tents. And we're talking about the very heavy materials. And the tents, when examined later, they said they were very old with a lot of patches. So they stitched this together.
I'll tell you what, Teddy, we're going to take our first break here. We're up against it here. So why don't we do that? When we come back, we'll find out what happened once they started on this trek. So we'll take a really quick break, and then we'll return talking more about the Dyatlov Pass incident with our guest, Teddy Hajiska. Stay tuned. More Midnight Society coming your way here on Midnight.fm.
to the show, dial 508-322-1985. That's 508-322-1985 or Skype midnight.fm.
And you are listening to Midnight Society here on midnight.fm. We'll take phone calls later, but I probably should have waited to hit that button. It's just force of habit because we have a lot left to cover here as we go on with our discussion tonight. We are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident with our guest Teddy Hajiska. We are talking right now about the Dyatlov group and how they are getting ready to start this trip. And Teddy, you were giving us the details of them getting ready before they actually started heading out to where they ended up. That they're, you know, it seems like they're very experienced. They know what it is that they need to do, and it seems like they're taking all the proper precautions for where they're going.
Yep, they knew, they had experience. They knew what are they doing. They haven't been to the area before, but they have been to winter tracks and they had the qualification. They were all members of a sports club of the Ural Polytechnic Institute, and they were very well assembled group. The dynamics and everything, they have been to tracks together before, and it was a lot of changes were in the composition of the group before they started, because some of them were not had to go to practice or take exams or prepare diploma works or something like that. So basically, I think they merged two groups, and the leader spot was available for Dyatlov to fill it in, and he led the group. But the group was not planned to be like with this composition till the very end. I'm going to go back to where I left previous part of the conversation. I mentioned that there were two girls because one of them had to carry a lighter backpack because she was shot in an incident, hunting incident. Actually, they were carrying a gun. Most of the groups that were going into the wilderness had to carry gun because they were expecting to encounter some animals and wildlife, and they had to defend themselves. So she was shot by accident, and her leg still was not too good. So she had a lighter backpack. So imagine all this weight had to shift to the rest of the group, and they really carry very heavy backpacks. So their night... Okay, from Ekaterinburg, which at the time was Sverdlovsk, they started with an 11-hour, I believe, train trip, which they changed to a bus, then to a truck. On the back of a truck, something happened which will possibly change the course of events. There was very windy. It was very windy. And the 10th member of the group got sick. His back acted out. He had this illness for a while. It's not something that sciatica, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen for first time on this trip. He knew about it. Every time he went on a trek, he checked the nearest where he could get help if it really got bad. So it did get bad. And at the last possible moment, he turned back with the sled that took the group to one abandoned settlement. This was the last point where they were seen by witness alive. And Yuri Yudin, the last member, the 10th member of the group, turned back with his backpack. They took some of his weight too, because they're like blankets and some of his like a vest, food. So they put this in their backpacks. They became even heavier. Everything I tell you, it's very speculative. Every fact has a shadow. Every account, every claim has to be taken with a grain of salt. In this case, it's a very salty case. I mean, everything it's has raises questions. Why did he return? To his dad, he was blamed that he knew something. That's why he turned back. I mean, the poor guy was so decent and humble. He hated the fact that he was the survivor of guilt, that he was alive and all his friends died. So to the very end, he didn't even advertise. I mean, at his latest years, he started talking and what he knows. He had to, but when he was younger, he even he moved to a city and didn't want anybody to know that he was the surviving member of this incident. I mean, it wasn't something to be proud of and to advertise and go on public talk about.
It was well known enough to the general public that they would know who he was.
Oh, sure. No. He was absolutely. He's a very plain, decent guy. I mean, nothing mysterious about him. Just the fact that he turned back. But it wasn't for first time that his back acted out. And it's so, if you look at the photos, you will see how sweet their dynamics are in the group. They smile, they hug, they love each other. I mean, they're really happy to be in the mountain, to be doing this hike. And the farewell with Yuri Yudin is documented, well documented. They were in a hurry because whoever was taking them, Uncle Slava, with the sled had to turn back with Yuri Yudin, and they were hugging very briefly, and one of the girls gave him a little teddy bear as a souvenir, which he kept till his very last day. And he said something that's very often used in books about the incident, that if he had one question to God, it would be what happened to his friends. So they were on the 28th of January 1959. It was the last place where they were seen alive. And so after that, they go on their own. No communication, no settlements, nothing. They're just on their own with only the stuff they carry on their backs, and they have to survive. They have contingency plans where to go if the weather really gets really bad. It's very well planned trek. They knew what they were doing. So they go over the frozen surface of the river. Then at some point they have to climb up a ridge. The plan was to go over the ridge, go down again in the forest. I'm mentioning the forest because it's essential for them. It's the taiga. So in the taiga, there are a lot of fir trees. The other name of the taiga is a snow forest. Their tent was designed, I mean, tents in general at that time were designed to hang on trees. So they were looking for trees to hang the tent, to pitch the tent, and also firewood. So if they go and camp outside the forest boundary, it's really considered a cold night. First, the tent has to be pitched on their ski poles because there's no wood, there's nothing to pitch it on. And then they have to spend a night without any fire, any warmth. And so this is considered a little bit of extreme. Yes, it's difficult, but nobody was giving them points to do that. And I'm mentioning this because this is how the tent was found. So there are 9 people left after Yudin turned back. 2 girls and 7 men. They were all very fit in their prime. One of them, it's instructor, he's not a student, Zolotaryov, who joined the group at the last moment. He had to make the trek because he was instructor in a tour base And if he had the higher qualification, which consisted in more hikes of a certain difficulty, category of difficulty, he would get better pay. So it was a practical choice of why join this particular track. He joined another one, but it was a longer one. So he wanted to get back to his family and actually his mother. He wasn't married. That's why he transferred to Dyatlov Group at the last possible moment. And he took the place of another student who didn't go, he didn't even start from Sverdlovsk. But we know about him because he was given back the money he put in the cash drawer of the trek and so on. These trips were partially paid by the sports club, and also the sports club were providing equipment. Not always, not all of the equipment. They were trying hard to find what was missing, like backpacks or any of the like the stove that I started talking about. They were radio engineering. Some of them were studying 50-year radio engineering. And they knew how to make radio stations, but it was really, they were short range, or I'm not very knowledgeable about the terminology, but they were useless to carry. I mean, to make a wide range radio station, it would be very heavy, and it wasn't, the sports club didn't provide anybody with that at the time. But it was, they were blamed for this, and everybody is saying, why didn't they have a radio stations with them? Well, it wasn't possible. It technologically at the time, they couldn't carry 20 kilo more for a radio station, and I believe somebody had to wait for their communications to come in. I'm not sure how it works, but I know that it wasn't something common. It wasn't done at all. So they usually their day went like that. They traverse, they stop briefly for one or two times to have some snack. Then they choose a place to pitch the tent, and they start working because it's a lot of work. They had to flatten the snow, they have to pitch the tent, sort all of the supplies, and the stove that they were carrying, designed by Dyatlov, was a suspended stove inside the tent, which had like a chimney. They had actually a pipe coming out of the tent, and you can see this on the photos. It was tested. It was working. I'm mentioning this because a lot of theories say that just the something with the stove, it was poisoning them, smoke filled the tent.
Smoke coming in, yep. I can see that.
Or something like that. But that stove was used only to warm them. They had to dig up a hole and make a fire outside in the snow to cook. I saw this when I was in the Northern Urals. This is how they actually do it. They dig a hole in the snow, and they put the firewood inside, so it's sheltered from the wind, because it's always windy. It's always windy in these places. That's not considered a bad weather. That's a common weather. There is no calm day. But sometimes just the wind is so strong that could be it's gonna take the tent and everything inside if it's on the top of the ridge. This was the first suspicion of the investigators, the way they found the tent. That was the first theory, that they were just sucked out from the tent by a hurricane, by a strong wind. Imagine what the weather is, if this could be the cause of a tragedy. Well, it wasn't the case, because the tent was still there, but it had big cuts in it. But let's go back. So they had to put up the tent, the stove, cook, and only then, when all the food is ready, they sat down, and if there was still light, they wrote in their diaries. This is very important because they would not waste a light of their headlamps or something. They had flashlights, actually, Chinese flashlights. They wouldn't waste the batteries because they're heavy to write in their diaries. So we judge when did they die by the last entries in the diaries. This is very important. And they were doing that only after all the work is done. Then they go to bed. The experienced searchers from the same club, they were, when they found the tent, they said, here is where their heads were. This is where their feet were. So if something was coming from the slope, down from the slope, it would hit first their heads and things like that. So they lay down and they just spend the night. It's details about the mountaineering from this time is the last two people, imagine nine people laying next to each other. The last two on the sides are usually wearing clothes because it's coldest if you sleep next to the tent side. So some two of them could be wearing more clothes because it's cold. They're on the sides. They also had ski boots, and inside these boots are valenki, which is a felt boot. It's something like a soft boot, which they could still wear inside the tent if it's cold, and which you could make several steps in them to go do your business outside in the middle of the in the middle of the night. You could still make like 10 steps in the valenki without the boots. I'm saying that because they were found without boots and some of them were wearing valenki. So let's go back a little
sure.
bit.
No, our listeners yeah. love the details. Like, we want to make sure that we give them as much information as we can. So feel free to jump around where you need to.
Yeah, I'm getting into details, but I'm sure that some of the listeners hear about the case for first time. So I'm going to just give the broad picture. Why is it so important? Who is wearing what? And if they're wearing their shoes and how did they die? Why is it such a mystery? Right. The mystery is that they missed the deadline. They were expected at a certain date. They didn't show up. So, couple of days went by, they still don't show up. The 10th member of the group, he went back to Sverdlovsk without, he didn't suspect anything happening. There were no indications for trouble. So he went in his village where he was from, and he didn't even check with the sports club at the time when they were expected back because he didn't know better. He was on vacation and he just related the message from Dyatlov that if the weather worsens, they could be late 2 or 3 days. This added to the confusion. When are they expected? So actually the families of the hikers raised the alarm that they're not back, not even Yuri Yudin. There were another group from the same club going in the area. They were supposed to meet, possibly maybe, but they didn't have any communication. So when they didn't show up in the, on the mountain ridge where they had around that time, possibly they could meet the two groups from different routes. The leader of the other group start asking, well, are they back? What happened to them? And this is when really all the chaos begin. It turned out that Dyatlov didn't leave one of the copies of the route notebook, which said where they're supposed to go. So at the beginning, they didn't even know where to look for the group. And massive search started. It's like the Air Force and many groups from the sports club started searching for them. That was unprecedented. Search for missing group. And well, 3 weeks after they died, later on I'll tell you why do we think they died.
Okay.
On the night of the first going to the 2nd of February. So 3 weeks after they died, but it's not so late after they were expected back. They were expected back on the 12th, 15th, and the tent was found on the 27th. So they found the tent on the ridge. And this is when everything started going into the twilight zone. The tent was pitched on a place where they were not supposed to be. It was found sticking up, so it's not avalanche. It's not something that actually destroyed the tent, forcing them to get out of the tent and in search for a shelter. The tent were standing up, very well put on the skis, on an even area of the slope. Like they really took their time to set it up properly. The tent was cut, big cuts like doors. It turned out to be from inside. So they didn't have zippers at the time. They had toggles, but the toggles were, some of them were unfastened, but it wasn't so difficult to just move. They had like a sheet, like a curtain to fend off the current, the draft. They didn't use the entrance of the tent. They cut it open from inside. Okay, you would say, well, it happened. Something scared them. They thought there is an avalanche, some cracking of the snow. They had to get out very fast. Yeah, but then we see footprints, which are, because of the weather, I made experiment myself. We went to the mountains in the Alps, and we just traversed in some place where it's unpopulated, nobody goes there. And 3 weeks after that, because of the sun and the wind, we saw our tracks, our footprints, and both they're sticking up like pillars a little bit, like 20 centimeters or something. So they were seen in the northern Urals. 3 weeks after they died, there were still footprints visible going out of the tent. And to me, personally, this is one of the more bizarre of evidence that they were not running. They were not stumbling. Nobody was hurt, limping, dragging. Not only that, they were not wearing shoes the skis were under the tent. So they were, some of the witnesses say that you could see that they were wearing socks, and they were found in their socks without shoes. But the most strange thing is that they were not going one after another. If you go into a deep snow, the first person makes the tracks, and the next one follows in that person's tracks. This is, I mean, common sense. Nobody will go make his own tracks without any reason. But these footprints that were visible and documented, they went abreast, like three people going together in a earshot as if they were talking. So we have a parade, like, okay, let's cut up the tent, go out, look at the sky or something. I don't know what the reason could be, but then we don't run. We don't go back to at least take our shoes or some coat or gloves or headwear. No, we're going to say jokes and go down the slope. I can't explain that. And another thing that I keep saying, I haven't heard anybody else to mention it, but they were not even turning around to see, to face the danger that made them leave the tent on first place. So who does that? And we see these tracks going down the slope for like 500 meters. So they were going very strongly in one direction. And that direction is not where they came from. Maybe I should mention that they found a cache site in the other side of the ridge. They left some supplies. They left a spare ski. They had food and supplies on the other side of the ridge, but they chose to go barefoot slowly down for a mile. Now, they had to sustain. The decision is made in the middle of the night. This we can tell by the content of their stomachs. So in the middle of the night, they decided to go out. There is no light. They had only like two flashlights.
I'm just going to hold you right there, Teddy, because we're up against our next break.
Okay.
When we come back on the other side, we will pick it up there. We are going to continue learning about what happened at the Dyatlov Pass. And then later on, we'll get into some of the theories about what it could have been that happened to the nine people out there. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Midnight Society coming your way here on Midnight.fm. Welcome back into Midnight Society here on Midnight.fm. Tonight we are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident with our guest Teddy Hajiska. And before the break, we were, as Teddy is taking us through what happened in the area that is now known as the Dyatlov Pass, you had mentioned that they had a second site, like a cache where they had saved a lot of extra supplies and, you know, kind of had all of this stuff in a separate area.
Correct. And the location of this cache site, it's also controversial because we have to look at their original planned route to see if, because they were supposed to go back and pick up their supplies on the way back. So on which side of the ridge should they put the cache, leave the supplies? It was The cache site was supposed to be on the other side of the ridge where actually they went down to die. So the reason why they left it before they went up on their last location of the tent is that they encounter very strong winds, and they put down this in the diaries. Actually, the last entry of the group diary from Dyatlov himself says that it was very hard to walk. It's a lot of wind. He actually wrote down that the wind is as if from a airplane engine, as if you stand behind the engine. And it was very hard to walk with the skis and the backpack, so they turned back. That night when the incident happened, they were supposed to be on the other side of the ridge and leave the cache site there, but they couldn't make it, and they decided to leave it on this side of the ridge. So this is normal practice to make their backpacks lighter to go to their final destination, which is supposed to be like 2 days trip. They had supplies for 2 days. They were going to Torten, let's mention that. That was the last destination to a peak that is not very high, but as I said, the weather, it's very, very difficult to do in this area. And Otorten is where the legends start now. Because of the case, they say that Otorten means in the local language, indigenous people, Mansi, that means don't go there. I want to start to say it right from the beginning, it doesn't mean that. That's okay. The original Mansi name of the peak is Goose Nest. And they have this legend that because of a flood that flooded the whole earth, only a goose nest survived because it was on the top of the mountain. Another, actually, Otorten is a distorted name of another peak that's close by and not that tall, which is also called Otorten and means the windy gate or something like that. It has something to do with wind. And the local people were calling everything with very practical names. And the location where Dyatlov group died, it's the nearest peak in the mountain is called Kolatsekhul. This is what the books and games are called, and it means the Dead Mountain, like the Dead Sea. Like it means nothing grows there. It's no game. It's no nothing there. Just it's not a place where anything can hold on because of the wind. But we now call it, even I am using this title, like a meta title for the homepage, Mountain of the Dead. You can hear a lot of legends that there were nine, and there is always nine. This mountain seems to claim nine victims always. Nine Mansi hunters that disappeared or died in mysterious way. UFO, Russian UFO researchers counts airplane victims that fell to be nine, but the nearest closest, it's like 200 kilometers away. I mean, any accident with the airplane that claimed nine victims. So there is not a lot of, and then after the accident, the rescuers were using helicopters, and eventually these engines had some accidents and fell from the sky, and some pilots die, and they say that also these pilots were nine and that they were taking part in the search of Dyatlov group, and this is why they died. So there is a lot of folklore about the area, and you will keep hearing that this is the mountain that's called Don't Go There. Now, Mansi could have said that, and a lot of people say that don't go there because it's you don't have any business going in the middle of the winter there. There is nothing to do. This is what the Mansi meant when they told them don't go there, not that the mountain is called that.
Sure. And not to interrupt you, but just if you could give us an idea about the Mansi and who they are.
Tim, please do interrupt me because I tend to be carried away. Mansi are the indigenous people that live in the area, and there is a wild speculation that if they live there, they must be at fault for what happened to the group. They tend deer. They're hunters, and they live from deer, and they look like if you have never read about tribes of this nature. They look like Eskimos, but they're not Eskimos. They just wear these big cloaks of made of hide of skin, animal fur, and they just keep to themselves. Of course, everything that the civilization does to indigenous people like this is affecting them. Like, if you give them alcohol, they drink a lot. And even now, as we speak, there is a scandal that Dyatlov Pass is in the center of. Everybody that goes to Dyatlov Pass nowadays goes through a hut, which is called Ilich Hut or Base. We went through there. This is the closest building before you climb over on the ridge to go to the pass. And now they want to build a complex with restaurants and a lot of things. Oh, wow. A businessman wants to do that. And the local Mansi oligarch or direct something that represents the Mansi Valeria Nyamov, he says, don't do that because they will forget to hunt. If you give them jobs at restaurants, it's going to happen like the Indians and their casinos. They're just going to forget and abandon their habitual way of living. They prefer to have it easy. If you have warmth, you have alcohol, you have easy jobs, they'll forget the hunting and everything. It's not left much of the Mansi. But this is the local population, and they tend, you will see in a lot of photos from the cameras of the group, they carve signs on the trees, which if you don't know what they mean, could look very mysterious. They usually say who passed there and what was he hunting. Sometimes they put down how much they hunt. If you see anything that you can read, like a year, I believe on one of the photos is carved a year, that's not done by the Mansi. They never carve any in Cyrillic or leave alone Latin or numbers. They have their own signs. And there are still Mansi. We actually, I met some of them. They really don't want to discuss the incident. They know nothing about the incident, and they were the first ones to blame about it. They were, this theory was abandoned by the, in very early in the case, in the investigation, because nothing from what the Mansi could benefit greatly was taken from the tent. Food, boots, jackets, flashlights, money. The girls were untouched. They were not forced or anything. No one will leave any of this in the tent. Knife, tools, skis. If the Mansi had anything to do with this, we wouldn't find any traces of them because they could take care of any evidence. But they had some strange behavior, as I hope to have time to discuss the investigation at the time. Everybody that was involved in it had a very strange behavior, as if either they were covering something or they really didn't know what they're doing. So the Mansi are still there. They don't want to discuss the case. And the Dyatlov group did not meet any Mansi. They didn't have encounters with the Mansi. They only discussed that they see traces of them everywhere. That's even a quote from one of the diaries. And Mansi, Mansi, Mansi.
And that would make sense. I mean, you would think, you know, they're in their area, so of course they'd see signs that they had been there.
Yeah, tracks, and they had a lot of hunting sites, like they were having a rest there, rest spots, and carvings, and ski tracks. One thing that's important for the case is that you could tell which ski tracks are left by the Mansi because they had wider skis. So in the testimonies, when Mansi were questioned and they said that they saw some tracks, they always say narrow skis. If it's a narrow skis, it's not the Mansi, so it's a stranger, it's somebody else. So they said, we saw narrow skis here or there or something like that. What else do you want to know about the Mansi team?
Well, I mean, I did see, well, you know, maybe we'll save that for the theories toward the end. I don't want to bring that in there now. Okay. We'll get into that a little bit later on. So let's just get back into the part of, you know, where the group was at this time.
Yeah, so they're going down the slope, and they keep this direction for a mile. So if you're scared or there's something you chase or something is chasing you, you could just stop in 20 minutes or an hour. They had to be walking at least more than an hour to reach the forest where they were found. Then if we consider that they were affected, but some kind of poison, delusion, anything, they would stumble and go apart or get confused or get panicky. But it seems like when they reached the forest, they had a very good plan how to survive the night, because they made a fire. They cut branches with the knife. Then they dug a bivouac, a hole in the snow. They put branches at the bottom. They made the flooring. They put some clothing there. There is a lot of activity in the forest, and I can't even believe this activity was done in during the night, because I have to mention that the flashlights were left on the way. One flashlight, very strangely, was found on the top of the tent. But not only that, and it was working, in a working condition. Below the flashlight was 10 centimeters of snow layer, but there was no snow on top of the flashlight. That was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second flashlight was found midpoint on their walk down, like in the middle of this going down a mile. The second flashlight was dropped, and we don't know if it was in on or off. The only thing we know is that when they switched it on, it was working, but nobody noticed if it was, well, it should be off, otherwise it wouldn't survive for 3 weeks. I'm not sure if I'm not confusing the two flashlights, which was in a working condition, but
sure.
I'm pretty sure that the midpoint was not working. It's on my side. So, because some people said that when they were going down, they left that flashlight to as a beacon to go if they tried to find the tent. So the midpoint was not drained from juice. So they don't have flashlight. They go down to the forest, and then they start some activity without any light in the middle of the night. They make a fire. They cut branches. They dig a hole. It looks like they're going to at least make an attempt to survive the night. Well, I have it, and here is another very strange side of the incident, is that they're not wearing their outerwear. They're in their underpants. They're clothed the way you spend the night inside the tent, as if you're awakened by something suddenly. And imagine even in your sleeping bag, although they did not have sleeping bags at the time, they were just having blankets. And you're rushed out of the tent. You flee down. This is what you wear. The clothes that you sleep in. But then they start dying. So the first two corpses were found next to the fire they did. The fire burned for half an hour, and then it just died down, as if no one was attending the fire. They had the logs. They could just push the log further into the fire and it would keep burning, but they didn't. So they found two frozen bodies next to the fire, but not in a pose, not positioned in a way you would imagine somebody to. They were with their hands extended above their heads as if somebody was dragging them and positioning them this way. And their clothes were all ripped off. Like they found pieces of their like leggings, of their underpants, and everything. They were naked. They found pieces of their clothes around wrapped around the foot of one of the girls, and then some of them just spread around or on the flooring of the snow cave or snow hole they dug. So they were very naked, with repositioned two bodies next to each other, one face down, one face up. So the searchers kept looking around, and the next bodies they found a couple of days later, actually the same day, they found two more bodies of Zina and Yatlov. They found them as if they were trying to go back to the tent. Zina made it to the closer to the tent. So they were as if they were going. I always say as if because nothing is what it seems to be. They just looked as if they were going back to the tent. And then a couple of days later, they found another body in between Zina and Dyatlov. So we have two under the cedar tree next to the fire, three trying to go up to the tent. And so the first five bodies were found 3 weeks plus a month after they died. And then nothing. They couldn't find the rest of the group. So they ruled out the case as a hypothermia. Actually, they couldn't find any other reason for the first five bodies to be dead. I mean, the cause of death was hypothermia. And so they said that it's a bad decision. They put the tent where they shouldn't. They left the forest. There was no explanation why did they cut the these openings into the tent, rendering it absolutely useless. They couldn't have shelter anymore. And they keep trying to find the rest. There is a massive search. The search camp was on the other side of the ridge. They found the Labas. The Labas is the name of the cache site in Russian. This is how they called the cache site. They found it. And 3 months after that, they had to go back to Sverdlovsk. The military took over because they had to cover a lot of space with probes, avalanche probes. They tried the mine detectors. They didn't yield any results because there was no metal on the bodies. They tried dogs. The dog found only one body of Zina, and they were really covered with very little snow, like 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters. The rest of there were four left, unaccounted for, were found in May when the snow started melting down. And this is when the mystery really deepens, and this is how just this case got really mysterious. The last four were found with injuries that could not be caused by incident, falling, or anything surrounding the where they found them. There were no high precipice. There is no rock that they could fall from. There is no boulder that could crush them. Two of them had multiple fracture lines without any external bruising. This is like something very heavy has to fall on top of you with a very flat surface to actually crush your chest and not leave any outside bruising or hemorrhaging, nothing. No signs of any injury from the outside, but they were all broken inside. One of them, we're talking about 6-7 ribs broken in 4 fracture lines. That's a flail chest, something you cannot survive. The pathologist ruled out, I mean, said, determined that they lived not longer than 20 minutes after the injury was caused. So any speculations that this trauma was caused at the tent by avalanche or whatever, it's doesn't have any reason to exist, because you cannot move. Nobody can drag you. You cannot stand up. I know it by myself. I had a flail chest, 6 broken ribs. You are flat. You cannot move. Nobody can make you move or lift you. Nothing. So two of them had multiple major chest fractures. The girl, Luda, one piece of her rib pierced her heart. So ooh, she died from that, and she died very, very short after the trauma. One of them had caved in skull. We're not talking fractured skull, caved in skull. The pathologist said that he died instantly. I mean, there is no way. But the fourth one didn't have any injuries, and they found them in a pile. Two men were hugging. I mean, the one that didn't have any injuries was hugging the one that had most of the injuries. And they had a lot of the clothes wrong. Like, we speculate that when somebody was dying, the still living were taking clothes from them and putting them on themselves. But we're not talking jackets. We're talking like underpants, ripping off underpants and wrapping your foot or something. So it's very, very strange. And then two of the hikers that had most little injuries, they seem to have died from the same force, and they had exchanged clothes. So if they die at the same time, how come one of them is taking the clothes of the other? And they weren't even in the snow hole that they dug to survive the night. They were 20 meters down the creek. And it's not very probable that the water washed them down because of the positions they were in. They were all, like, clinging together. And you will hear that they were missing their eyes, and one of the girls was missing her tongue.
Yeah, let's get in. We're going to take a break here. Why don't we get into that when we come back on the other side? Because those are, you know, talking about the traumatic injuries that they suffered, and also, you know, being found with these missing body parts. Let's get into that a little bit when we come back, because I think that that's something that is, you know, a deeper part of the mystery. And also, there's some speculation about how that could have happened, so I'd like to get into some of that as well. We'll be back in just a few moments talking more about the Dyatlov Pass incident. We are unpacking it all to get tonight with our guest, Teddy Hajiska. We will return to talk more about it when Midnight Society continues in just a few moments here on Midnight.fm. Welcome back to Midnight Society here on Midnight.fm. We are continuing our discussion tonight with our guest, Teddy Hajiska, as we are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident, and we are discussing some of the injuries that were suffered by members of the group. We talked about some of the trauma, which, as Teddy said at the beginning of the discussion, kind of, you know, the type of injuries you would expect to see in a car accident, you know, as a result of being hit by a car, even though there's no car hitting them out in this area. And certainly not only would that not happen, but there's no sign that it happened. But also, as Teddy, as you mentioned before the break, missing eyes, a missing tongue. These are the kind of details that only makes this story even weirder than it already is.
Yes. I'm mentioning this because everybody is repeating it as a part of the case. They even start with that. Although it's very, if you ask pathologists, because we should turn to specialists, experts, to explain if this is common or not. It's not so often that we see corpses, especially found 3 months after they died in the wilderness, under the elements, in the water, because they said they reached the water. They have been submerged in water, or parts of them, for 2 weeks. Before that, they have been buried in the snow. It could be a normal way of decaying, the soft tissues to be eaten by rodents and stuff. So I want to disappoint you that it could have a very normal explanation. I'm trying to be unbiased, to mm-hmm. just lay down the facts on my side, but I gather opinion on both sides, and the pathologist said that this shouldn't be considered as something, a foul play or something ripped their tongue out. You should just read the coroner's report. It says missing tissue or something like that. It's not, it doesn't say that it's cut, clean cut or ripped out. It's just missing. And, it's, that's not the weirdest part of the case for me personally.
Okay. But Are there other cases that you're aware of people that might have been, you know, found dead out in similar conditions where they might have had similar things happen to them due to, you know, predatory animals or whatever else that might have been that caused it?
There is a pathologist, a modern pathologist, Tumanov, who is very familiar with the case, and he's often present in TV shows, radio shows, and he actually took part. He was a member of the expedition of the prosecutor's office. I think Komsomolskaya Pravda is inviting him as an expert. And he repeats this all the time, that this is normal for bodies to be, when they were found in the open, the missing. These are the tissues that start missing, first. It's a normal way of decaying of a body that's left outside.
But that does also lead to another question, though. Why one and not all?
The missing eyes, you mean?
Yeah, and why would only one have a missing tongue and not another one?
Well, they were positioned in a different way. She was having her, to start with, she had her mouth open and her face in the water.
Yeah, that could make a difference. Yeah.
And she wasn't the only one with the missing eyes. It depends if the rodent finds you face up or face down, I believe. And there is no indication somebody like ripping the eyeballs out or carving them out. There is nothing, although they were pretty much washed out by the water and they have been for 3 months outside. So there is a lot of decay going on. They just look very scary. And people tend to take the easy, the more visual facts of this case and just make a theory out of it and keep repeating it as if there it is. Well, they even say because Luda had a temper and she had a big mouth and she was speaking back at people. Even she says this in the diary, why I'm so angry. And she actually says that she's sad and she feels even evil. I mean, it's a strange as a premonition lines in her diary, but she wasn't very easy to communicate with, and people say that maybe she crossed somebody at the villages where they passed through and they followed them and they ripped her tongue out as a result. You will hear so many theories, but let's finish with the facts, because
sure,
we haven't even we did scratch the surface, but there is more. There sure. is more weird facts. At the end of the investigation, at the time, for some strange reason, the lead investigator ordered radioactive testing of the last bodies. In the middle, because there was a 2 months, nothing was found, and we don't know what the investigator, what leads did he pursue or what did he do at the time. Some speculate that he was called to Moscow, instructed to cover up the case, that there was something from above, a bigger picture, that he was silenced. And his behavior actually talks about that, because he was later on, many, many years after that, apologizing to the families and that he didn't do his job. He didn't actually close the case, and he ordered radioactive testing. And three of the clothes turned out to be radioactive. The day after he got the results, he closed the case. And he actually moved the analysis of the clothing to, he classified it. He moved it out of the official case files. And we find this strange. I mean, it could be explained that maybe it wasn't pertinent to the case, that they instructed him to remove everything that's not related to the case and just close the case, because he started looking into the sky. He, the lead investigator, imagine all this trauma and everything, all the facts that he gathered, and he started questioning the Mansis about light events that happen in this area. We know about the polar lights, and there are a lot of light show in the skies in this area, but people were reporting flying globes, orbs that were, they were just flying, but they were UFOs, so people were worried, and they didn't know if there is some testing going on, or should they be worried about, hide, or do something about it. A lot of the searchers also saw it. Meteorology stations reported it, and the lead investigator, many years later, like 30 years later, he published The Mysteries of the Fireballs, and he insists, now imagine, the lead investigator says that the hikers were killed by targeted ray of energy that came from the universe. I mean, how crazy is that? And if I had the power to close the case, if it's going in that direction, I would close it too, because that they closed the case very prematurely, with the cause of death to be overwhelming force. This is a wording that it's also questionable, because in Russian it sounds more like a force of nature. They told him, the party, the leadership of the party, his bosses, they just told him to close it as a natural cause. I mean, something happened to them and they died. They didn't explain the traumas, the injuries, the radioactive clothing, or why did they leave the tent. But they said something spooked them out. It was, they blamed Dyatlov for taking wrong decisions. That, for example, he mentioned three mistakes, that he left very late the last day they were alive. They left late. They pitched the tent on the top of the ridge as a result of missing the pass. This is what he said. They missed the pass. That's why they climbed on the wrong path. And they had to pitch, so they were, I don't know, half a kilometer to the left of the route, so it was getting late. And judging by the last photos of the cameras of the hikers, it was getting 5 or 6 in the afternoon. They didn't have much light left, so they decided to pitch the tent, so it was the wrong place. They shouldn't have done that. They should have kept into the forest boundary, but okay, even if he blames the group leader for choosing a wrong place for the tent, nothing explains how they died, but they closed the case. And because there is a lot of public pressure, I would think including because the rest of the world, not just the Russians, started talking about this case because it was unknown. There was nothing in English about the case when I started looking into it. I mean, not case, the case files were not translated. You didn't even know where to look for them. Everything was just articles explaining the case in five paragraphs with a lot of advertising and just pitching a theory. Okay, UFOs, Yetis. Oh, yeah, Discovery Channel. Their first movie was that Yeti killed them. This is one of the theories that is going strong. Why? Because in one of the photos there is a outline of someone fuzzy, not on focus, that looks like a Yeti. That must be the Yeti that killed them. There is another also detail that contributes to that theory is, this is important what I'm going to say now. The last document that we have dated from the group is from the 1st of February, and it's, I translate as a combat flyer. The Russians in the socialist time, they used to have a propaganda flyers. Usually they were sticking them on walls so people can read them. And they had this as a joke written. They call it Evening Kotorten, which is like a newspaper, like a combat little newspaper. And they had jokes. And one of the jokes was that we're in the area where Yeti lives. Okay, Discovery Channel takes this joke because everything else on this newspaper is about love, is about the birth rate amount, the hikers is increasing. It's about the homemade sled done by engineer Kolevatov is good only to in the train or on the bus, but it doesn't work if you have to pull it. Things like that, or how many the Armenian quiz? How many hikers can survive under one blanket, something like that. And one of the jokes is that we are in the place where Yeti lives. Oh, that must be a documented like statement that they saw Yeti and it's after them and it killed them. So
right. It's kind of the sexy theory, you know, if you're the Discovery Channel, you know.
No, but then they did a much better Expedition Unknown. The episodes that Josh Gates did were really informative, and he left the open ending. Like he said, well, at least we don't believe it's these 10 theories, but we don't know what happened. So we need more information, X factor, something to bring more light on the case. So they also had good movie, I mean, Discovery Channel, which I was invited to. So I have to say that I'm very pleased. But this is, I was saying that before I translated the case files, and I have to mention that a week ago I published the classified volume 2 of the case files. And this is what the prosecutor is waving at the their public appearances, that they're reading the classified files. And you have them. You have transcribed them in Russian, in English, everything scanned. You can have all the information you can take on the case. And I can say it from the bottom of my heart that the more you read, the weirder it gets, because there are discrepancies, there are conflicting testimonies. The same person is changing, it's saying conflicting facts or information. Or for example, one of the facts in the investigation which troubles me is that at the location when they found all the dead bodies, it's a fairly small area. The cedar tree under which was the fire had the branches broken up to 5 meters high on the side of the tent. And this, we think that somebody climbed to look in the direction of the tent to see what's going on or something like that, but he couldn't see anything because it's dark. But let's say if there was a source of light, maybe they could see something. And then he fell. They saw skin of the hikers in the bark of the tree, and so it fell. Some of the branches broke. Some of the branches were cut. They were not found close to the cedar tree. They were found some distance away, and a lot of other trees were cut. But they never found the knife. In the protocol of the items that were found at the location, there is a sheet of knife. How do you call it? The thing that you put the knife in, right?
Oh, yep, the sheath, yep.
Yeah, well, that could not be confused by to be a knife, because the same investigator, first he said, well, there is no knife. And then in the conclusion to close the case, they kind of go over the whole case, what they know about it, and you can read it on my site. There's so many discrepancies. He even quotes the clothes wrong, like, okay, he's wearing her hat. Well, he's not. Like, he's naming a different pieces of clothing on different people. And he knows better because in the classified volume 2, you have the drafts. So he personally got the receipts of the items he was returning to their families, and he knew whose hat was that, but he said that somebody, the wrong person, was wearing it. And this is very small detail of the all the inconsistencies in the resolution of the case. So it's either he was sloppy, or he was under duress or something. But why would he just confuse things that don't mean anything? He's just making it more confusing. He also let me say something about the strange member of the group, Zolotaryov. He's poor guy. They exhumed him. I mean, his body. They actually excavated his body in 2016. Komsomolskaya Pravda managed to drill through the bureaucracy of the Russian administration and find the cause. I mean, they actually, the family of Zolotaryov asked for the body to be dug up because it wasn't listed in any cemetery. I mean, the cemetery where the monument was didn't have in the registry a person with this name to be buried there. So they, for 2 years, they fought, and they finally, they exhumed the body. So everybody was waiting for something strange, either the body's not his or there is no body or something, to give it a cause for the investigation to be reopened, like this is a known person or the Zolotaryov is missing or something like that. And there was an expert who did a skull superimposition on the spot, on the location, and it was Zolotaryov. At least by the photos that we have of him, his skull matches 14 points more than enough, so it's him. They took a DNA. They took sample for a DNA testing. And shortly after, I mean, I underline shortly because they didn't take the time necessary to do that properly, they announced on Russian TV that it's not him. And this started the wildfire of speculations. Okay, who is he? He killed him. He was darker than the devil. He was, all his life, facts from his life were dug up. He has a child. We didn't know that anybody survived the group, but he actually has a child from a woman he wasn't married to. That's why he doesn't have a family, and that child is given for adoption, so we don't he doesn't have a son or a daughter, and everything, samples for a DNA match are taken from other relatives. So, but they say the body that's buried in the cemetery is not his. So who is he then? And couple of months after that, the central lab of the Russian Federation made the test, took the time, made it properly, and said, no, it's him, but we still cannot rule out his brother, who was a German spy and went missing during the war. So there is not one particular detail in this case that doesn't drag more mystery to itself. So now, who is his brother? And the Zolotaryov was a KGB agent, that we know. So maybe to survive the shame and the pressure of his brother being a traitor, he had to be enlisted. And so what was he doing with the group? There was a common practice for people to be injected in groups that go, I don't know, close to a border, but where can you go from the Urals? But they said maybe they could try to abscond or just to check the dynamics, the mood, something like that. But they said he was on purpose injected to the group because we don't know. He was much older, much more different, but he seemed to be very well adjusted to the group. They liked him. The beginning, they were a little skeptical about the conflict in the leadership of the group because Dyatlov is supposed to be leading the group, but this guy is much more experienced. I mean, he has under his belt, he has a war, he survived the war, which is by itself is a miracle. He had tattoos. We found out at the when they exhumed the body that he has a lot of tattoos. None of his relatives knows about any of these tattoos. And he was a teacher. I mean, he was training school kids. He was not supposed to show any tattoos. So in any of the photos, he's always wearing like long sleeves. Then they say maybe the photos we see of him is not him, that they replaced him during the war. And that's a completely different person because the photos that they did the skull superimposition was after the war. So who really was he? But his mother saw him, and she has in the classified volume 2, there are heartbreaking letters from his mother that she's requesting his camera to be returned. And the camera, when I mentioned the camera, Zolotaryov is a very bad photographer, but they found a camera around his neck of the body. So he didn't have shoes, but he has a camera around his neck. That's and it's a camera. Yes, Tim?
Yeah, that's very interesting. You're gonna not grab your shoes when you're running in a hurry or not, as we'll get into, but you leave your shoes, but you grab your camera. That seems very odd. But we're gonna take our next break. We can get into that and so much more when we continue on with our discussion with Teddy about the Dyatlov Pass incident. And a little bit later on, we can open up the phone lines. We still have a whole bunch of stuff to get to, so I want to try and make sure we can get all the information in before the end of our discussion tonight. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Midnight Society in just a few moments on Midnight.fm. Back with more Midnight Society here on Midnight.fm. We are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident with our guest, Teddy Hajiska, as we are talking about all the different details surrounding the case. And as we start to dig into it, we start to find out more of these strange circumstances and also the myriad of theories that try to explain them. It doesn't seem like there's any one thing that anybody can settle on to try to figure out any of these individual details. And you had mentioned, grabbing a camera before grabbing your shoes as you're running out of there. And I had mentioned, you know, that you're running out of there in a hurry. You grab your camera and not your shoes. But in all actuality, we were talking about how they cut the tent to get out of there in a hurry. But the tracks that were left behind, I guess, didn't indicate that they had been leaving the tent in a hurry.
Right. I had to string up the facts into theory before going to the pass because Discovery Channel wanted me to present a theory. And here is what I did. It's not that I believe it anymore, but this is how I can explain this. The searchers had this sighting of globe in the sky at night, and the guy on duty or someone that went out saw it, and he called the sleeping his friends in the tent. So what they did is they rushed out in a hurry in their valenki or even barefoot, trying to step on the branches that they usually put down around the fire just to look at the event in the sky, just to see what he was talking about. And because it lasts for not more than a minute, so you don't have time to put on your boots. And at some point, he just looked at himself, this searcher, and he saw himself exactly clothed as they found the group members. And so my theory, this is what I came up with, is that two of the men that had the valenki and were better clothed than the rest, which could be explained that they were sleeping on the far sides, on the outsides, close to the tent edges. But let's say they went out. One fact is that they found traces of urination outside the tent, possibly two men. Well, how these traces remained for 3 weeks of snowstorm, I don't know. But
right, yeah, I'd question
well,
that same
they
time.
Found it's in the case file. So they went out to relieve themselves. They saw something in the sky, and Zolotaryov rushed inside, took the camera to try to take picture, and they tried to recover the film that was inside this camera, but it was in the water for too long and it's very damaged. But they managed to make a book out of the whatever developed. They blew out some defects on the film, and they see it's on my site. If you check Zolotaryov's camera, they see flying dragons and chicken, and it's called spiritual photography or something like that. And one of the frames, it's a little bit bigger and it's very damaged, but you could see that you can say somebody's trying to make a photo above three heads, like above the people that are looking at the sky. He could be trying to take a shot of something that's in the sky. So that was my theory, that they all went out dressed like that to look at something in the sky. And then somebody confronted them with guns and said, go down to die. He was trying to kill them from exposure, and that they were marched to go in that direction. And that's why they didn't turn around, that they were under duress. They were ordered to go down, and they went down and tried to survive. But they made the mistake to light a fire, well, it could be seen by the tent, and that actually the perpetrators could, they were just rummaging inside the tent, eating some food, trying to figure out what to do next, and they cut some of the small, because there's, at the eye level, there are smaller cuts that you don't go out, you just cut to look through, that they were looking, and when they saw that they are surviving, they didn't die on the way, they cut the tent to destroy it, and they went down and start killing them one after another. One of the bodies that was found under the tree had foam coming out of his mouth, and people say that this is what was common technique of KGB to torture you when they sit on your chest and you suffocate basically, and sometimes foam can come out of your mouth. the same pathologist that I mentioned that explained the missing tongue and eyes, his theory is that there was an altercation. He says that there were some bruising on the knuckles of parts of the body, that traumas that you sustain if you are in a close fight, like a wrist fight or something, that there was altercation. He also says that reading the coroner's report, some of the bruises were getting colors that like they were caused days before, that they were starting to heal, like blue and green, things like that. So according to him, there was a fight. He doesn't say if among them, but like they were confronting something. They were in a fight defending themselves. So I'm saying that it could look like something killed them in three or confronted them in three different instances. It started from the tent. Then they sat on top of them, tortured them. He also says, Tuman says that they were tortured with the fire because some of the fingers were singed and their feet were singed. They either tried to see them if they're really dead by putting their feet in the fire, or they were torturing them. So this pathologist says that the injuries of some of the bodies clearly point towards torture and altercation. That's what he says. But nobody explains the injuries of the last. But it seems like the longer you live, the worse death you suffer.
Well, and also, wasn't one of the theories that if they did die of hypothermia, that the latter stages of hypothermia actually causes you to be misperceiving yourself as getting warmer and you take clothes off?
The paradoxical undressing. Yeah, but they just left their clothes at the tent.
Right. You would think that if that was the case, they'd be taking their clothes off where they were.
Exactly. And it seems like they ripped off clothes of the friends' bodies and put them on themselves. Like, I'm taking your sleeve and putting them on my foot. So this is not undressing. This is actually trying to cover the exposed parts of your body. It doesn't look like undressing. If you're undressing at the latest stages, around the body should be scattered clothing. There's nothing like that. All the clothing was inside the tent. But yes, that's a theory. They keep repeating that and comparing different the deaths in the mountain. That, as in Dyatlov case, here is another hypothermia with paradoxical undressing. No, there is no signs of paradoxical undressing. Yes, they were found in their underwear and in a state that you would never venture more than 10 meters outside of the tent. And some of them were completely their skin is exposed, legs and everything. I need to just throw in the mix, because I'm feeling that we're going to go into theories that people, like, it sounds like you had enough, right, to explain all the facts that you have heard so far, but there are many more. And there is no theory trying to explain all of them. Every theory just picks one, like, right. Oh, they didn't know what they were doing, or they were not wearing their clothes, or something like that, and builds a theory on a particular aspect of or some fact.
And requires you to ignore other facts.
Exactly.
In order to get there,
cut off. Yeah. You just ignore the rest of the facts. And I'm just going to throw in the mix so you will know what to look for. Orange skin. Everybody says that at the funerals, they seem to be in a dark orange color. So they say that this is because some secret weapon was tested and they were like exposed to it, things like that. Another thing is that their faces were in a horror. Well, I mean, that's not possible, because the pathologist said that that's not possible. Mm-hmm. to have a mask of horror on your face. You go through, all the faces, the muscles relax, then they stiffen in something else. Another thing is that Zolotaryov was wearing not only a camera around his neck, but one of the searchers, who it's credible, says that he was present when they found him. He was having a notebook in one hand and a pen in the other, and that the military colonel just took the notepad and he cursed and said, oh, he hasn't written anything. Nobody else has seen this notepad or has ever, we don't know where that notepad is, but you can hold on to something after you're dead. The cadaveric spasm is a very rare occurrence. Those are small details. More strange details that are cut off are that pilots that took part in the search saw the tent and bodies in a different location than they were found, before they were officially found. And like the top, the cherry on the cake, if that's a bad humor to say, but it's a testimony of a former nurse from Ivdel Morgue, where all the bodies were taken. She says, not once, I mean, she claims that to the very end, that they were 5 plus 1 later on, 6 bodies brought to her before they were even looking for them, and she disrobed them, washed them, put new clothes on them, and prepared them for burial. That the coroner in the morgue did external examination without autopsy, and as it was usually the case, if there is a if there is death in the mountain by obvious cause like hypothermia or avalanche or something like that, they just had the coroner examine, write a burial act. I mean, that this body is ready to be buried, and they usually buried them in the close by populated area, a cemetery. They didn't even ship them back to where they came from if it's far away, like Sverdlovsk. So, and nobody actually wants to put this into context. What bodies? Where? How? It's impossible. She's demented. She doesn't know what she's talking about. So a lot of course, you can say, well, people are, they seek to be a center of attention, people to, talk, take interviews, but they're not paid for this.
Right.
And they're actually trying to hide. She didn't like all this attention from the very beginning. So there is more. There is a lot to read. And I'm trying to publish everything I find for you to try to connect the dots into your own theory.
Sure.
But
yeah.
All the dots.
And by doing so, you know, as we said, you know, you're putting all of the different theories and possibilities out there, even as out there as some of them may be. You present them on the website in a way at dyatlovpass.com. You present them in a way where people can read them and understand why some people take them seriously. Even as crazy as they may sound, you know, you present it in a way as if you're saying, well, if these people are right, here's why they think that they would be right. So it's a very objective approach to that. It doesn't seem to be dismissive of any of the ideas.
No, we shouldn't. My motivation to list as many theories as I can, I haven't listed all 75, although people ask about them, where is the list of the 75 theories? I'm trying to also point to the expert or whoever came up with that theory and its advocate of this theory. He should be the one answering, explaining, and I'm listing the contacts for them. This is the case with the infrasound, with the katabatic wind. I mean, people have their own theories and they should defend them. The Mansi also, there is a book by Svetlana. She should be answering this question, not me. I'm kind of putting everything in writing and directing them to the source. So I don't have to take the time to explain this theory because it's not my job. I don't create it. I don't birth this theory. And I don't want to defend it.
Right. You're not. Because that's
you're going to hear from me only why I don't think this happened. Tim, to tell you the truth, I don't know what I'm going to do after I give everything from me to this theory. It's what I'm going to do with all this. I mean, I'm not going to stop until I have a theory that I believe in and that I can defend it.
Well, no, totally understandable. Let's break down some of what we just kind of covered a little bit there as well. So, you know, we said that it's probably not the Mansi. It could be that there was, you know, at least there were some reports that the tent and the bodies were in a different place and had been moved. And then the question becomes, you know, who moved them, and then how did they cover up the fact that they did it? Because there were no other tracks found except for the ones that the actual party themselves made.
You have to keep in mind how was the scene treated. At the beginning, they were looking for live people. It was a search operation, it was a rescue operation, mm-hmm. not a search operation. And I don't believe that anybody was keeping any special attention. They were not trained. Those were his fellow hikers and friends. We know that they cut the tent to try to see if somebody's inside. So some of the cuts are done by the searchers. Also, how do you preserve the tracks? The tracks of the barefoot tracks, it's okay. They're strange. They should be preserved. But we have a photo of a footprint wearing a boot, and it's documented in the case file as not belonging to the searchers. Then when you go down in the forest, there's so much activity in this area that it's hard to say. The snow is covering. Next day, you don't see anything from the previous day. So it's right. hard to say if there was traces of outsiders and other people. I mean, I have to tell you that everything you read, you should take with a grain of salt, like make your own decision. Read the case file. How did they describe the fact that there were no other parties, traces from other people there?
Right.
What are other people? I mean, sure, there should be traces of Mansi because this is a hunting spot for them. They were spending time exactly where the bodies were found, so some of the branches could be cut from them, by them. And so that's also objective. Were they other traces of other people or not?
Right.
Who said that? I mean, there wasn't a yellow tape, keep clear, evidence, crime scene, nothing like that.
Well, and one of the big theories that people seem to have, and it seems to be the favorite of one of our favorite skeptics, Ben Radford, he has this out there that there was an avalanche, and that's why they were reacting. They heard the avalanche coming. They cut the tent to get out of there in a hurry. And then when they got out of the tent, they tried not to move too fast as not to incite the avalanche. You know, they were trying to move away in a timely fashion, but not to cause extra stress that would cause that. But there were no outward signs of there having been an avalanche there.
No, and you don't go abreast. If you are trying to escape from an avalanche, at least you will try to go away from the path of the avalanche. They were going straight into the path of the avalanche. They should just move into the ridge where, I mean, it's obvious where the avalanche will go if there was one. And then, okay, so let's say, because this is one of the most popular theories and the prosecutor's office is investigating an avalanche. There is not the angle of the slope is not enough for an avalanche, but let's say it could come from far above them. Then what happened? How did they die? Why didn't they go back after they saw that there is no avalanche?
Right. And they would have had experience. They would have known at least what to expect if there was an avalanche, even if they'd never actually been in one beforehand, they would be, I would assume, trained in how to deal with one of those if they were at the skiing level that they were at.
I have been in avalanche, and all of us parted in different directions. I mean, in panic. Mm-hmm. Everybody jumped in a different direction, and one of us remained at the edge of the avalanche, and he actually dug us up. I was completely covered, and I can tell you that you run from an avalanche. You don't go slowly, trying not to cause anything, because it's if there is there are signs of an avalanche, something caused the avalanche, and it's going to go very fast, and you should move out of its way immediately, because you are not the one causing the avalanche. Whatever caused it, or it's causing it, if you hear cracking of the snow, you have to get out of there very fast.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But still, I'm pointing that theories target different sides of the case, like the why did they leave the tent? Then what happened? They have to extend to what happened down there, because actually why they left the tent is not what caused them to die. They could have returned. They could have survived a little bit, I mean, longer to the next day. What caused them to die in the way they were found down in the forest?
Yeah, that to me seems, you know, it sounds on the surface, you know, no pun intended, that it's a very plausible thing, but it pretty quickly falls apart.
And do you want me to tell you what the most popular theory in Russia is that is has a big book about it?
Sure.
Rakitin's theory. Rakitin is actually not a person. He's a team of 40 researchers. And his book, which is big and very popular, is The Controlled Environment. This is one thing that I always had a very hard time, like, swallowing and digesting this information. He has a lot of history and a lot of background of the time and everything. He makes a very good analysis of what was the dynamics and mood and their state of mind by the way the photos, the cameras, he counts more cameras that they were found. But his theory is that KGB was meeting CIA to hand over the exposed clothes as evidence of how advanced the Soviets are in making radioactive atom bombs or something, how advanced they are. And that only Zolotaryov, maybe Kulevatov knew about it. The rest were not into the what's supposed to happen, including Dyatlov. That Zolotaryov made him pitch the tent where they did, and something went wrong, and I guess CIA killed them all.
Oh,
that's the. This is the most popular theory.
Right. That's a little out there. Well, we're going to take our final break here coming up. When we come back, we can dive more into that. We can dive into some of the other things that you had mentioned. I want to get into those, such as the infrasound possibility and the very interesting theory about the wind, which is some people's pet theory as well. So we'll get into all of that and more. We'll try and squeeze in some questions as well. I have the different modalities up there to get questions in there. I'm trying to check them all, but I'm also trying to keep my computer from overheating. So we'll try and get into as many of those as we can before the discussion is over. But more to come as we are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident. And really, as I said, we're only going to be able to scratch the surface tonight because there is so much. It does go so in-depth. So all I can recommend is go to midnight.fm. Click on Teddy's photo right there. That'll take you over to her website and the forum site as well. And you want to talk about a rabbit hole? I just found how you're going to spend your entire weekend when you get over to that site. Now, she spent years building all that, so keep that in mind. You're going to dive into that, and by the time you come up for air, you're going to realize it's already Monday again. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more Midnight Society on Midnight.fm. Welcome back. Our final segment of tonight's program as we are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident with our guest, Teddy Hajiska. And again, as I mentioned before the break, just go to midnight.fm. You can find a link there over to her website, but it's dyatlovpass.com. dyatlovpass.com. Just go to that site. You will find all of her research there. So much to check out. And as I said, we're not going to be able to get to all of it, but we're going to get to as much of it as we can. And in the last segment, Teddy, you had mentioned the idea that it could be infrasound. And when I hear that right away, I think it must be some sort of piped in infrasound, some sort of experiment or some sort of something or other that might have been going on in that area that they happened into, or that somebody saw them as potential test subjects because they were out there. But as I read more about that theory on your website, it's actually a natural version of infrasound. Oh, are you there, Teddy? Oh, there you
I'm
are.
Sorry. No, I had the mic mute. I'm sorry. Yes, it's the infrasound is a natural phenomenon. It's not something caused by a military testing or something like that. It's called Karman Vortex Street, and I'm reading could have produced a terrifying, powerful sound, which is proven to induce irrational fear in humans. The two theories that, Tim, you mentioned, I didn't. You said infrasound and katabatic wind that mm-hmm. You want me to comment on are, I'm glad that you mentioned them because the people that advocate and introduce these theories have done their homework. And it's not easy to have a theory that explains what happened there. Those are natural phenomena. But both people that... the stand behind these theories that mentioned for first time infrasound and katabatic wind are, I'm very respectful to them because they did their homework. It's not like throwing a theory and people say, well, maybe they were struck by a lightning or maybe the stove exploded or something like that. No, the infrasound was introduced by Donnie Eckhart and he has a bestseller book, Dead Mountain. And he, for the first time, explained and translated in English and met with the people. He traveled to Ekaterinburg and to the Urals. It's a very good book. And usually when you get closer to the case, you have to have a theory. That's why I don't know if he really likes his theory, but he... he speaks about infrasound to be causing them to get out of the tent and behave irrational. He's not explaining anything else. I mean, there is a lot in the book about the case, but the infrasound theory just explains how they heard something. They started feeling really uneasy inside. They couldn't eat. They couldn't sleep. They didn't even made up the stove, which they didn't because there was no wood around. And at some point they wanted it to stop because there is this sound. It's in your head. It's making you really hurtful and you want to get away from the sound. And he explains why could that sound be there and getting stronger. And so they wanted to get away from the sound that make them go down the slope. But the theory ends there. His speculation about what happened then, it's that they were frightened and it was very cold and there was a lot of horror and pain and that's it. I mean, the infrasound made them go down into the forest. Again, that's a bestseller. So read it. It's a very good book, but it doesn't explain what happened after they went down away from the sound. That's the infrasound theory.
Right.
The katabatic wind, it's a very sweet person, Richard Holmgren. I know him. He actually made expedition to the pass 10 days after us, I believe, at the same time, and he wanted to test his theory. The katabatic wind, he may be angry with me that I'm going to simplify the term, what means I imagine it as a microburst. You know what microburst is? When the wind, the air goes down with the force.
I actually had that happen right outside my home studio here a couple of years ago. There was a tree outside the window, and the microburst hit right over the tree. It split the tree right down the middle.
Wow.
Just out of nowhere.
Okay. The definition of the phenomenon is described as a ball rolling downhill by gravity. Hence, it is also labeled gravity wind, a wind that carries a high density air from a higher elevation down a slope. Actually, Richard placed his tent. He spent the night where the Dyatlov Group tent was found, and he directed the tent in a different way, expecting actually a katabatic wind to happen. So he went there and tested his theory. And if I wasn't going with Discovery Channel, I knew the Russians that helped him in the expedition, and they said, you know, why don't you come with Richard on expedition? I said, maybe I'll have the luxury of Discovery Channel. Because they skied their way to Dyatlov Pass carrying everything. It's a really interesting story of the katabatic wind author, who I expect to have a YouTube film, that movie, the documentary that I'm gonna mention in the site. And so it's an interesting theory about something that can phenomenon, actually, that can happen outside, but it doesn't explain how they died, and they were not running. Even on his illustration that you can see, I published on the site. By the way, everything on the katabatic wind is given to me by him himself. I asked him to write down the copy that he wants me to publish on the site, and it's his words. It's very interesting. So those are the two phenomena that you mentioned. I also have a gravity fluctuation. Like, so they have been sucked out of the tent. Why not their socks and boots? I don't know. It doesn't say. I have a lightning strike. What else? Do you want me to especially discuss a specific theory?
Yeah.
Okay, Mansi, shroom. The Mansi gave them some shrooms because this is a psychedelic, so they didn't know what they were doing.
Didn't that theory also go the other way too? Weren't there some people that think that the Mansi themselves were on the shrooms and became kind of, you know, they kind of snapped a little bit on them?
They jumped on their chests. Yes, this is what Svetlana asked in her book, Don't Go There. It's her theory, it's all about Mansi. But she doesn't say how the case goes unbiased and just say what could be explaining all the weirdness. She's kind of introducing all the facts only pertinent to the Mansi theory. She's making them look worse than they are. I mean, she's not saying things that are not true, but she's omitting everything else. She's just mentioning how weird the Mansi were and how they have these habits and who else is there. Basically, her explanation of the case is Mansi live there, this must be them. And yes, how they kill them, but at least she's trying to explain the traumas of that couldn't be explained, the high velocity chest fractures and the caved in skull. So she says that the Mansi, when they take a lot of shrooms, they can jump on top of their chest. There is a little bit different injury that you make when you jump on somebody's chest, and there won't be such a clean fracture lines. There will be many fractures, but not so clean as they were. They're just a whole rib cage is flattened. And just on two of them, and they really, if you look at their traumas, it's like you can tell which way they were laying down on the ground when it hit them. Lyudmila was laying on her back, and Zolotaryov was laying on his back, and she was laying on the side, as if they were like that, sleeping, and something happened, or they were laying down and something happened at the same time on both of them. And then the skull, it's nobody. So Svetlana also at least is trying to explain the injuries by Mansi jumping on top of them. Nobody else is explaining the injuries. Let's mention the foundation. There is the memory of Dyatlov Group fund in Yekaterinburg, and the chairman is Kuntsevich, and he's one of the most active researchers and followers of the case, and he's on all over the all the appearances in the media. He goes to the pass every winter. Sometimes during the, because sometimes you have to look for objects during the other months of the year because you can see on the ground. The official theory of the foundation, Dyatlov Pass Foundation, Dyatlov Group Foundation, is secret rocket launches that went bad. Something fell. Something fell on them, or they saw something, and that they were cleaned because of what they witnessed. They say that the military went there, killed them. And he goes even to the extent when you ask Kuntsevich to explain things like the broken branches or why he said that they were dropping the bodies from a helicopter, but the ones with the worst injuries were not under the cedar. He says that the branches were broken by the bodies that were dropped by the helicopter. He also found pieces of a rocket stages fallen on the pass, which turned to be from a later years when the technology was advanced a little bit more. They said that the pass is on the trajectory from missile launch pads, and that something blew up in the middle. So something happened, and they have to be cleaned because of what they witnessed, or they were killed by the pieces, and they had to be cleaned. And that this is a cover-up, that everything is staged by the government, something, military, and classified.
Sure.
So this is the official version of the to this day from the foundation.
And there are some paranormal theories that are out there, and let's kind of address those a little bit as well. One is that it could have been some sort of Yeti-type creature.
Right. I don't know how to tackle this theory because there is no any marks on the bodies by either teeth or claws or
right.
anything. I mean, you can die just from fear and fright that something is coming towards you. But a lot of people are saying, I think in Mansi language is called Menk. There is a creature. It doesn't look like a monkey, like Yeti, but it's some creature in the forest, in the taiga, that they tell bedtime stories about. But when we interviewed the Mansi woman that Josh Gates met, she said she hasn't heard of Menk. Well, of course, she doesn't want to discuss the case at all. Her husband left. He didn't want to be present. So they don't talk about these things. But every time when there is a case with unexplained facts, there is something extraterrestrial involved to
right,
try to explain it. That doesn't leave any tracks.
That's the other possibility, too, is that, you know, there are a lot of folks that think not only this, but there's been other cases. There was one here in the United States, I believe in California, where that theory has also been floated, that it's basically the American version of the Dyatlov Pass case, and that theory has been floated that it was aliens that came in and took those people and somehow, you know, did whatever they did and then killed them and left the bodies there to be found.
The bodies were in a very different stages of traumas. That's what bothers me. Even the last four, they were not all squished by this high velocity object. One of them didn't have any injuries on him. Actually, this is very, it's going to be very interesting. I don't want to use this, the word interesting. If his body gets exhumed, this is a very, controversial fact right now. I have to mention that the prosecutor's office is the only, organization, organ that can, undergo or appoint any testing because of statute of limitation. Nobody else can, even the Zolotaryov's body can be said that it's tampered with, and anything that's found could be not admissible in court. They're the only ones, and everybody's waiting now if they're going to exhume the rest of the bodies. And Kolevatov is the fourth body of the last group found, is one that doesn't have anything strange on him, not even knuckle bruises, nothing. Only that his neck is bent a little bit, which we, if he's dug up, we can see if his neck is broken or not. That's not going to be a definitive of anything, but we don't know why he died. And did he die just trying to hold his dying friend, or what happened there? I'm saying that they're found in different causes of death, and that's troubling me, because why some of them were just not scattered and the rest are killed on the spot?
Right. Yeah, there should have been some more consistency in that regard. One of the other theories, and it kind of ties into the movie, that the Devil's Pass movie that inspired you to look into the case, is the idea of that they were involved in some sort of, you know, teleportation or time travel or some sort of weird experiment like that.
Yeah, even one of the Russian researchers found the bunker. No, he didn't, but he says he did. He would say anything to be on camera, and they don't invite him anymore. He says that there is a bunker and Nazi artifacts and stuff like this that was portrayed in the movie. This theory or whatever story is also tries to explain the fact that the nurse from the morgue in Ivdel saw more bodies that they were actually, because she saw 11 bodies. And in the movie or some of the, I don't remember where I saw that they claimed this to be true, that some of the soldiers that went into the area after that, unrelated to this incident, they went mad when they saw themselves coming towards them, so they kind of saw copies of themselves, and they went crazy, so they were discharged.
Hmm. Yeah, it seems like, you know, some of these theories that we talk about, and of course, as I mentioned, you list them all right there. Well, like you said, not all 75, but a good amount of them, and with an explanation to each one at the DyatlovPass.com website. But it seems like most of the theories almost all of them would point at it just kind of being wrong place, wrong time. You know, that had they not been there, this wouldn't have happened. That they weren't targeted, they just happened to be going through a place that they shouldn't have been.
I consider those the most valid and reasonable theories. Yes, I do believe, I can't believe that something was following them or intentionally sent them to that spot. They were not even supposed to be there. And it's nothing can follow you, not at a short distance. And even they didn't know where they're going to spend the night. That something followed them and killed them purposefully. I think whatever happened was there. It was something happened to them there. And I also think, since I haven't heard of any other case that's so complicated, and you haven't even read the rest of the details, because it's really weird trying to explain it, what happened, what we know happened, and then trying to explain it. I think that more than one weird thing happened to them. and overlapped in a way that we cannot distinguish motivation from means and from result. We can see why would anybody kill them in the way they were found, what is the cause of death, and how to tie this with how the investigation was led and how they were found. But to me, the only way to tackle this case is to question everything. Is it really like that? Like that? For example, well, the tent, why was there? What was cut? Why did they get out? Why did they walk down? Well, did they really do that? Or why did they die that? Well, did they really die there? Did they really died like that? Well, the cause of that you can argue because the coroner says, well, they died from this and that. So these injuries were caused. But were they caused there? Did they die there? This is what I start, because if you can, it's a dead end with any theory you follow. So I think we should take some steps back and see where did we make the presumption that got us into the wrong exit of the freeway, because it's very easy to go down a theory if you accept it at the beginning. Then you render everything to support and to exclude.
Right, a confirmation
bias. Depending on the theory.
Yeah. And I think this goes, you know, I spend a lot of time, a lot of my life researching the Lizzie Borden, you know, murders here in Massachusetts. And it's one of those things where everybody that gets involved in it thinks that they're going to be the one to solve it, that they're going to find the one piece of whatever that's missing that will find the answers to all this. And I'm sure that that's what a lot of the people that look into this do. I mean, obviously, you know, as you said, that's not your approach with it. You're just trying to present all the information. But most people that are trying to, you know, research something are trying to have that end result of solving the mystery. And if that's the case, it's way too easy to just start pulling on threads that will only unravel it in the way that you want it to be unraveled.
Correct. I always looked at this case as a puzzle, as a box with pieces that I don't have the picture of. I just needed a site, a structure where when I learn something, I have a place to put it. That's why this site is getting so deep and so elaborate, because there is a lot of information and it's just I'm making the puzzle, putting the puzzle together, but I don't know the final picture.
And you touched upon this a little bit earlier, but there seems to be renewed interest in getting this case, you know, solved, though, that things have been reopened in it to try and find more solid answers.
Yes, the prosecutor's office does have an interest to solve the case, because the speculations are too much, and right now it's spreading outside Russia. And the third DNA of Zolotaryov's remains is sent to DNA testing to the States. We know that, and we're waiting for the results. So it seems like this is going to cross borders, and it's making headlines. It's already been announced that there is new investigation. So I believe there is going to be a development. It's very, very interesting. It's so cold, so many years, 61 years since it happened. And I think we're gonna see the resolution of the case.
So then if that is the case, what happens then with your research if they solve it and they find the information? Are you gonna, you know, take the site down or pull down some of those theories, or do you wanna kind of keep them out there as part of the journey of getting to that solution?
I will never kill the site. The site is always going to be up. It's like a book. When you close the book, you don't throw it away. This is a story. This is a story told how what happened, how we portrayed the case, how many years, what we thought about it, how we investigated. Absolutely not. The site is always be there. And I am looking forward to have something resolution to explain the case, and just leave me time to go back to the mountain, because this case sucked me out of the mountain. I was full-time traveler. I was spending a lot of time there, and all the time that I put into the site is holding me on in the civilization. And after the case is closed, I'm gonna go back to the mountain.
Excellent. Now, in the final few moments that we have, let's talk about the forum, because as much as you present all the information on dyatlovpass.com, there's a forum that people can go to where they can actually discuss and go back and forth with other people that are interested about these different theories.
This has been the means, the forum that this case is discussed until now, and it will always be a platform where people can publish their opinion and discuss and comment, and it's a completely different form of approaching this case, and there wasn't any place where people could discuss in English. And I have 40 countries, people from 40 countries, actively discussing the case there. And if you're interested, this is the place. I'm also trying to keep up and monitor, but my area is the site. I'm putting everything I find on the site, and there are moderators and very active members in the forum, very, very smart people and actually experts in various areas like pathologists and doctors of different science, and very useful information there. I wish I had more time to read everything that's in the forum. Thankfully, they send me what they consider more important for the case.
Sure.
But this is the place to be proactive about the case.
Well, I think all of our listeners are going to be heading over there, signing up for the forum, and they're already telling me that they're planning on spending the weekend on your website. So, you're going to have all kinds of new people joining into the discussion, I think, after this weekend.
They're all welcome.
Well, thank you so much
for open arms.
Thank you for joining us tonight and getting up early for us and sharing all this information with us. And, I'm sure we'll have you back again to discuss this even more, perhaps when we finally end up getting a resolution for it all.
You're very welcome, Tim, and I will definitely, you'll be one of the first people I tell you that I have cracked the case.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good night, and everybody out there, thank you all for tuning in, not only just tonight, but all of this week. Man, what a week it's been. I mean, we have had some fantastic discussions, some really cool guests, and guess what? We're going to do it all again next week. Because that's what we do here on Midnight Society. We bring you new and interesting discussions each and every weeknight. And if you have ever missed any of the past episodes, just sign up at midnight.fm to become a member, and you will get access to all of our past episodes. But I'm looking at the schedule for next week, and not only are we going to be talking about some really cool topics, but remember, just a few weeks ago, we had the strange but true story of one of the most craziest UFO experiences I've ever heard about, Jim Wittenberger. He's coming back next Thursday for part two, where we're going to get really deep into what it was that happened to him. So don't miss that episode. You can catch the first half in the archives if you've never heard it, but you will hear all about what happened to him when he was 4 years old, all about what happened to him when he was 10 years old, and we only really started to get into what happened to him later in life before we ran out of time. So we'll be talking to him next Thursday to get the rest of the story. But if you want to find out all the guests we're going to have next week, just go to midnight.fm on Facebook and on Twitter, and we will post that on Sunday. But that'll do it for this week. Until next week, everybody out there, have a great night, a great weekend, and enjoy every sandwich. Or, it's summertime, every burger on the grill too. We'll be back on Monday.